I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Iranian foreign minister has criticized the United States for imposing new sanctions on his country, vowing to retaliate against any such measure.
The U.S. sanctions are turning out to be jokes these days. When you go through the lists, there are people who died 7 or 10 years ago. The Americans themselves are tired of such games, but have resorted to taking these repeated measures.
Amir Abdullahian says Iran will respond in kind to the new curbs. He added that the U.S. is seeking negotiations with Iran, but at the same time continues with the policies of its former president, Donald Trump. He underlined that the U.S. sanctions, especially the most recent ones, have no impact on the Iranian nation. He, however, said that the new measures show Washington is pursuing a hypocritical approach in its foreign policy. The top diplomat also slammed the European signatories to the 2015 deal for issuing an anti-Tehran resolution during a recent meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors. He said that they are seeking to exercise false pressure on the Islamic Republic.
Our cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency is still in place. Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mr. Islami, and his colleagues have made significant progress in cooperation with the IAEA Secretary General, Mr. Grossi. But unfortunately, the European signatories to the Iran deal are seeking to exert false pressure on Tehran. They are the ones who have not abided by their commitments under the deal.
Amir Abdullahian said that the Europeans played with time and used the U.S. withdrawal as an excuse to wriggle out of their own deal-related commitments. He vowed that Iran's response to the recent European violation of the JCPOA will be based on a parliamentary law and the deal itself. The U.K., France, Germany, the EU keep in place sanctions related to Iran's ballistic missile and nuclear program in violation of the 2015 deal. Human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi tells us how U.S. sanctions are backfiring in more than one way.
These sanctions are obviously another way of the U.S. empire showing how weak they are. Countries like the U.S. use sanctions as a tool to undermine the economic stability of countries like the Islamic Republic. They think of it as a tool that will weaken a country, but it has proven to be on the contrary. The U.S. in the past has sanctioned China. They've sanctioned Russia as well. And today we see that China and Russia have both economically flourished. As a matter of fact, I don't think I would be exaggerating if I would say that when a country like the U.S. that is so dependent on import, is so dependent on its export, when it sanctions countries like the Islamic Republic, Russia, or China, it is actually harming its own economy. It's harming its own people. A capitalist country like the U.S. really can't afford sanctions. Whereas these sanctions have, in a lot of ways, benefited the Islamic Republic in a sense that it has forced the Islamic Republic to develop economic policies that rely more on self-reliance.
Iranian security forces have nabbed a team linked to a terrorist group that was planning attacks on an illegal gathering in the western province of Kurdistan on the anniversary of last year's unrest. Security officials say the team entered Iran from Iraq's Kurdistan region and was planning to carry out the attack in the city of Saqqaz on Friday. Four terrorists have been arrested, along with assault rifles, handguns, Iranian military uniforms, and knives. According to a statement by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, several other terrorist teams were also arrested in other western cities. Terrorist groups based in the Iraqi Kurdistan region have staged several attacks inside Iran concurrent with the 2022 riots in the country. Recently, Iran officials have issued several warnings of a new plot by the enemies to stir unrest on the anniversary of the riots that broke out following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman, last year. Iraq says it's wiped out anti-Iran terrorist groups from areas in Erbil province near the border. The commander of the Iraqi Border Guard said that his forces have taken back the areas which were under the control of terrorist groups. Iraq, the statement says, is determined to maintain security in the region bordering its neighbors. Now, this just days after the Iraqi foreign minister paid a visit to Iran. Fuad Hussein on Wednesday assured Iran that Iraq will not let any terrorist group use its soil as a launch pad to attack neighboring countries, including Iran. He also expressed Baghdad's commitment to security pacts with Tehran. The mourning ceremonies are underway across Iran to commemorate the modern anniversary of the 8th Shia Imam. The northeastern city of Mashhad, that's home to the Imam Reza Shrine, is hosting around 4.5 million pilgrims. They've converged on the holy city for mourning ceremonies. Hundreds of thousands of mourners from across the nation have also walked all the way to Mashhad. Measures have been taken to house the pilgrims. The modern anniversary of Imam Reza, which falls on the 16th of September this year, is a national holiday in Iran. Representatives of Yemen's Ansarullah movement and a mediation team from Oman are in Saudi Arabia to negotiate a permanent ceasefire to end the war on the impoverished Arab country. Ansarullah's top negotiator says that humanitarian issues will be the focus of negotiations with Saudi authorities.
The issues we have to touch on during negotiations in Saudi Arabia include humanitarian affairs, paying the salaries of all employees, opening airports and ports, releasing all prisoners and detainees, withdrawing foreign forces, rebuilding Yemen, and reaching a comprehensive political solution to the conflict.
The official expressed hope that negotiations with Saudi officials will pave the way for an end to years of instability in war-ravaged Yemen. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war in Yemen in 2015. It led to the killing of tens of thousands of people and the displacement of millions more. Yemen has been under an all-out blockade. The UN has already described the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Israeli military has launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip after the forces opened fire on Palestinian protesters along the barrier bordering the coastal territory. The regime's military has claimed that the airstrike targeted an observation post of the Hamas resistance group. The military says it was a response to what it called the riots near the fence separating the besieged region from the occupied lines. The strike was reportedly carried out with a drone. Spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement has slammed the attack, saying it shows the criminal nature of the regime. On Friday, hundreds of the people in Gaza held rallies near the fence east of Gaza in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. Israeli forces fired rubber-coated bullets and tear gas, wounding a dozen people. Ashraf Shannon says that Israel wants to instill fear among the Palestinians, but nothing will stop them from continuing their resistance.
Nothing has happened to prompt the Israeli regime to carry out two drone attacks against Hamas security observation posts in the east of Gaza City, except for the peaceful protests that were held along the security fence and along the so-called buffer zone east of the Gaza Strip. All of a sudden, after the protests ended, Israeli drones fired a rocket east of the Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City, and minutes later they fired another rocket east of central Gaza. They want to instill fear into Palestinians, especially the protesters. Palestinians in Gaza, a very young population, nearly 53% of Gazans are children under the age of 18, and this is why most of the injuries during attacks and even during protests and during wars are children and young people, and it seems nothing will stop them from continuing the struggle.
Now, meantime, the Israeli regime has denied life-saving medical treatment for hundreds of children in Gaza by denying them travel permits. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip must obtain such permits to leave the impoverished territory through an Israeli-controlled crossing to travel to Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent has more.
Sick Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip continue to suffer due to Israel's illegal and inhuman practices. According to a report released on Wednesday by the UK-based organization Save the Children, the Israeli regime has deprived some 400 Palestinian children in Gaza of vital medical care in the first half of 2023. Gazans, including patients, must obtain special permits to leave the territory through an Israeli-controlled crossing. Human rights groups have raised the alarm over Israel's violation of international laws by depriving Gazans of their freedom of movement.
Israel continues to violate international laws and norms by denying patients and their companions the necessary permits to travel outside Gaza. Israel is endangering the lives of those sick children by depriving them of urgent medical care.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs needed for treating patients suffering from severe illnesses. Last year, three Gazan children died while waiting for their exit permits. Press TV met with the Zidane family in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. Israel has repeatedly denied them an exit permit.
My son is very sick and needs urgent medical care outside Gaza. He's 15 months old and only weighs 5 kilograms. There's no medical treatment for him in Gaza, and Israel refuses to grant us exit permits. I call on the whole world to save my son.
Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished Gaza can be a stressful and unpredictable process. Nearly 1,100 patients have died in the territory because of the Israeli blockade in the past 16 years.
There is no secret about the procedures which have been implemented against the Palestinian besieged Gaza Strip over the past 16 years, and especially over the past year, in which the Israeli authorities have denied entry to many hundreds of Palestinian children from getting medical treatment in the West Bank and East Jerusalem hospitals. And that is consistent with the Israeli apartheid regime.
The health sector in Gaza has been grappling with an acute shortage of medicines due to the Israeli blockade in place since 2007. Tel Aviv's blockade has taken its toll on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip. Hundreds of Palestinian patients, including children, have already lost their lives due to Israel's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Now in Burkina Faso, the foreign ministry has expelled the French embassy's military attaché over what it calls subversive activities. That's the latest anti-France move by its former colonies in Africa's Sahel region. The ministry says that the attaché and his team have 2 weeks to leave the country. Burkina Faso is also closing the French military mission. Several French media outlets have also been suspended in the country over the past months. Similarly, in neighboring Niger, anti-French sentiment is still strong. French President Emmanuel Macron is accusing Nigerian military rulers of taking the French ambassador hostage.
Quant au Niger,
in Niger, we have an ambassador and diplomatic staff who are literally being held hostage in the French embassy as I speak. Food deliveries have been prevented. They are eating military rations and they are staying there because, quite simply, France, which supports democracy and considers that there are no double standards for Africa, considers that President Bazoum, who is being held hostage in his own country, is the legitimately elected president.
Macron's comments came as the French ambassador has refused to leave Niger even after being ordered to do so. The country's new rulers have also torn up military cooperation pacts with France and asked the troops to leave quickly. People in Niger have also held several rallies in support of the new government since it took over in July. People also demand the withdrawal of French soldiers. Waterlogged streets, upturned vehicles, and damaged infrastructure, the scene of northeastern Libya, where devastating floods last weekend left a trail of death and destruction. Some 11,000 people have been confirmed dead, and thousands more remain missing on that after Mediterranean storm Daniel hit coastal towns and cities. Derna is the worst hit city, where the storm swept away entire neighborhoods, causing two dams to collapse. Some 2,200 buildings have been destroyed. Rescue teams are trying to extract possible survivors from under rubble. Thousands of corpses are also washing up or decaying under rubble, which adds to problems facing residents. Authorities are burying victims in mass graves, despite warnings of health impacts. According to a UN report, some 1,000 people have been buried in mass graves so far. The leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has paid a visit to an air base in Russia's Far East as he continues his official trip that has irked the West. According to Russian Defense Ministry, Kim Jong-un inspected Russian nuclear-capable bombers. He was accompanied by Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu to the airbase outside the city of Vladivostok. Other Russian warplanes were also on display there. Kim arrived in Russia's Far East on Tuesday and held a summit with President Vladimir Putin a day later. The U.S. and its allies suspected the two leaders may have clinched an arms deal. Moscow and Pyongyang both deny that. The pair, however, say that they want to boost their defense cooperation. Now with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
France's ban on the abaya is the latest example of state Islamophobia, as well as a cynical electoral strategy to seduce the far right and split the left. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, France's latest ban on abaya dresses in public schools will not surprise any observer of the French political scene, since the so-called headscarves affairs first broke out in October 1989. At the time, three Muslim girls were kicked out of their school in the city of Kiril for refusing to remove their hijab. The incident was followed by a long list of increasingly virulent state and societal Islamophobic acts, with the abaya ban as its latest addition. Gabriel Attal, the 34-year-old newly appointed National Education and Youth Minister under President Emmanuel Macron, is thus unsurprisingly following what is now an old, well-established and predictable script, using the same rhetorical toolkit. He invokes the fallacious, ready-made argument of defense of the Republic against alleged provocateur, those girls who wear abayas, who test, attack, and seek to destabilize our nation, as he claimed. It is the same fake alibi, couched in hysterical rhetoric, which state officials employ each time they want to ban this or that visible manifestation and public presence of Islam, especially feminine outfits like burkini or the hijab of female soccer players, to name just two other recent French campaigns prior to this latest ban. Following months of controversy about whether or not abayas should be banned, this decision, announced by Attal during his very first high-profile interview on August 28, is simply the latest episode of France's old witch hunt against any Muslim or those perceived as such too visible in the public space or clothing too ostensible, as the March 2004 law states. Despite this penalty for a country that has sadly become a world pioneer of state Islamophobia and is increasingly seen as such internationally, this ban is nonetheless particularly shocking, even for those who have come to expect such developments from France. First, by its zeal and rapidity, Attal was appointed by Macron less than a month ago, having assumed office on July 20. But the measure, which will impact tens of thousands of schools, took place on the first day of the new school year. Attal has nonetheless been firm on the fact that if those students refuse to remove their outfits, they will not be allowed to attend classes. And Macron went even further by insisting that the enforcement of the ban will be uncompromising. Second, the new ban is shocking because of the odd and twisted priorities it reveals. For years, the public school system has been collapsing under multiple structural problems, including dramatically insufficient salaries, the loss of social consideration and status for teachers, increasingly difficult working conditions and high levels of burnout, anxiety and depression. One consequence of the degraded situation of the French public school system has been the difficulty, the impossibility really, in attracting enough teachers, which for years has resulted in a grave recruiting crisis, doubled by a crisis of trying to find temporary replacements. As a result, last year 4,000 full-time teaching positions were not staffed, and a staggering 12 million hours of classes could not be delivered to the students. And that was in junior high schools alone. In today's France, millions simply can no longer keep up financially and are reduced to saving on food and skipping meals. The latest figures show that no fewer than 16% of the entire French population is going hungry and depriving themselves of food. Even those who could afford enough to eat without going hungry had to change their diets and adopt cheaper food options. Now, after seeing their already insufficient purchasing power decreased by a full year of inflation, which in the key areas of food and energy reached 15% or more, the already impoverished French have to face yet another price hike of 23% on school materials compared to last year. Yet, the very first measure of Macron's new education and youth minister will have been to ban abayas on the very first day of classes. The opportunistic electoral strategy at work in this decision presents an even more cynical motivation for the ban. Besides the obvious attempt to appeal to the conservative and far-right voters, for whom there will never be enough bans like this, and who keep accusing the government of weakness towards Islamists, as they claim, Macron seeks to fracture his left opposition in three different ways, in a classic divide-and-conquer maneuver. First, because the main leftist coalition assembled by Jean-Luc Mélenchon in the last presidential campaign, the New Ecological and Social People's Union, is anything but a solid, monolithic bloc, especially on questions related to laïcité and Islam. As shown again by their divergent reactions to this ban, it is actually deeply divided between the center-left parties like the Socialist and the Communist Party, who mostly support such bans and laws, versus those who fight Islamophobia more vigorously, especially Mélenchon's own La France Insoumise. Each of these parties is furthermore internally divided on those issues. Finally, there is also a deep divide between the leaders and prominent figures of the NUPES coalition, such as Mlancon himself and Clementine Otin, who are resolutely against such bans, which they are currently fighting tooth and nail, and their own voters, who are predominantly for the ban. This ban is thus a perfect tool to weaken the opposition. On the one hand, it reopens and aggravates the double internal split within the left in general and NUPES in particular over such measures. On the other hand, it emphasizes the division, widens the gap, and drives a wedge between the main opposition leaders like Mlancon and their own voters.
When your horse returns to Alcamp Riderless.
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyarat Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyarat al-Ashura. So stay with us.
Allahumma ij'alni 'indaka wajihan bil Husayn alayhi salam fi ad-dunya wal akhirah.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this part of Ziyarat al-Ashura. اللهم اجعلني عندك وجيها بالحسين عليه السلام. O Allah, make me from among the distinguished near you through Hussein عليه السلام. Make me distinguished near you through Hussein. After we discussed the different connotations, different meanings, different possible meanings intended by Zair in this part of Ziyara, through the word wajiha, distinguished or accepted, we moved on to say what Bil Hussein alayhi salam means. This Bil Hussein means we seek to be stationed as one of the distinguished ones close to the Almighty Allah through Hussein. And this Bil Hussein means through Hussein's words, through his thoughts, through his deeds, and through his personifications. Now, Allahumma ja'alni indaka wajihan. O Allah, make me distinguished near you. Mentioning this phrase, عِندَكَ وَجِيهًا, enables the Zair, actually, to declare that what is important to him is having a status and position near Allah. Once he has realized this, then the Zair would not sacrifice that for any worldly position that people may offer him. اللهم اجعلني عندك وجيها بالحسين. When the Zair realizes what this distinguished station is, he would not sacrifice it for anything. This preposition ba in this phrase, وجيها بالحسين, is for mediation. And it is actually ba السببية. So one of the variable meanings of this phrase is, O Allah, make me in your proximity distinguished through Hussein, through the power of Hussein. It can also confer the meaning of taking Hussein as one's guardian and master and following whatever he says. And consequently, it would mean, O Allah, make us in your proximity distinguished through obeying Hussein. Terminologically speaking, we can say that Ba in Bil Hussein either signifies Al-Wilayatu Takwiniya, this ontological guardianship, or Al-Wilayatu Tashri'iya, the legal guardianship of Hussein alayhi salam. In other words, both of these kinds of guardianships are intermediaries for acquiring a higher status, a status which is distinguished near the Almighty Allah.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is, do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates him, he understands his dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So the last part of this phrase, اللهم اجعلني عندك وجيها بالحسين في الدنيا والآخرة. O Allah, make me distinguished near you through Hussein, where? In this world and hereafter. في الدنيا والآخرة. The word dunya is the feminine equivalent for the word adna, which we all know, and it signifies the lowest realm of existence, which is this material world we live in. In Bihar al-Anwar, we have a tradition and about which Allama Majlisi narrates. Yazid ibn Salam is reported to have asked the Holy Prophet about why the world was known as Dunya. The Prophet said, it is because the word Dunya is low and was created lower than hereafter. And if it would have been created together with hereafter, its inhabitants would not perish in the same way that the inhabitants of hereafter do not perish. Ibn Salam said, then inform me why the hereafter is known as Akhirah. And Prophet said, this is because it is later, it comes after dunya. Its years cannot be described, nor its days enumerated, nor do its inhabitants die. Dear listeners, in another tradition, a Jew asked Amir al-Mu'mineen, the reason why ad-dunya was known as dunya and akhirah was al-akhirah, and Imam alayhi salam is reported to have said, وَإِنَّمَا سُمِّيَتِ الدُّنْيَا دُنْيَا لِأَنَّهَا أَدْنَى مِنْ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ. Imam says, dunya is called dunya because it is lower than literally everything. And akhirah was known as akhirah because therein recompense and reward is necessary. Dear listeners, the last point that we can discuss regarding this phrase is the interrelation between the world and hereafter. It is imperative for us to know this fact, that although dunya is separate from akhirah, They are the same reality, but of different levels. The hereafter, which includes the intermediate realm of existence and the realm of Qiyamah, reflects the higher reality of this world. So, those who feel that it is possible for the one to attain a rank near Allah in the hereafter, although he is deprived of the same in this world, are mistaken. This is because the virtue of hereafter is determined by the virtue of this world. And if one strives to totally submit to Allah's will in this world, he would realize how great he always was near Almighty Allah. فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ اللَّهُمَّ اجْعَلْنِي عِنْدَكَ وَجِيهًا فِي الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةِ Both in this world and hereafter. So, perhaps the reason why we mention in this world and hereafter is to seek such acceptability that will always remain. And whosoever is wajih near Allah in this world is also the same in hereafter. Because the hereafter is the actually kernel of this world. And the challenge, however, is to maintain that station near Allah until the person leaves this world. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. We are done with this phrase of Ziyaratul Ashura. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces have recently raided several homes near the occupied West Bank city of Ariha and brutally assaulted a 17-year-old Palestinian girl. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Israeli regime forces have recently brutally assaulted a Palestinian girl after raiding several homes in the Arab Melihat community northwest of the occupied West Bank city of Ariha. Hassan Malihat, the general supervisor of Al-Baydar Organization for the Defense of Bedouin Rights, told Wafa News Agency that Israeli troops attacked a 17-year-old Palestinian girl after raiding her family house in the said community. The Zionist regime's violence against Palestinian women is routine in the occupied West Bank. An investigation conducted by Israeli rights group B'Tselem revealed that last July, scores of Israeli troops and army dogs broke into the home of the Palestinian Ajlouni family in Al-Khalil, separated the men from the women and children, and forced the women to undress. Meanwhile, the Prisoners and Ex-Prisoners Affairs Commission said in a report Palestinian prisoner Fatemeh Amrane, 41, from the northern West Bank city of Jenin, was subjected to the worst kinds of abuse and torture when she was arrested by Zionist regime forces in occupied Al-Quds. Amrane was arrested on September 4th in occupied East Al-Quds as she was coming out from Al-Aqsa Mosque. She told the commission's attorney, Hassan Khatib, that an Israeli troop kicked her, claiming she tried to stab him. Then other troops attacked her and severely beat her until she lost consciousness. When she woke up, she found herself shackled inside a police jeep. Amrane was then transferred to the Jaffa Gate police station, Al-Qishle, where she was interrogated, tortured, and beaten. Amrane reportedly told the lawyer, "They put me in the prisoner's transport bus and they stepped hard on me." Adding, "Sometimes the bus would go fast and then stop suddenly. They transferred me from one place to another to put pressure on me and to infuriate me. Police women tightened my handcuffs to hurt me while they pushed me, kicked me, and beat me." According to the reports, Amrane was also terrorized and violated while Israeli police women strip-searched many times. She told her lawyer, "They ripped my outer garment and then they transferred me to Ramle prison where I slept without eating anything. Then they put me in solitary confinement in a dreary and coarse cell with a bed and thin leather mattress, no pillows, and a dirty and stinky blanket." Amrane's attorney said that the bruises on the prisoner's body were still visible and that parts of her clothes had blood stains on them. According to Tasnim News Agency, the United Nations has called for an investigation into the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by the Zionist regime forces in the West Bank's Al-Khalil. The regime forces entered the Ajlouni's family house on the morning of July 10th. Two female troops took the 53-year-old mother, her 17-year-old daughter, and the mother, three daughters-in-law, all in their 20s, into the children's room where they were compelled to undress. Armed with rifles with an attack dog, the occupation troops also threatened to unleash the dog if the Palestinian women did not comply with the order to strip nude, even as they conducted body searches of the clawed men. Farhan Haq, the deputy spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, responded to a question about the assault, stating, "We would stand against any form of collective punishment." He added, "Obviously, this reported incident needs to be looked at and investigated thoroughly." Additionally, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, expressed her outrage on Twitter, saying that such incidents are absolutely appalling and asserting this relentless assault on people and rights must end. Amal Ajlouni, one of the women subjected to the strip search, shared her traumatic experience with the Israeli rights group B'Tselem, stating, "I can't forget what happened, the search and the humiliation I went through in front of the female troops and the helplessness and shame I felt in front of my children. They are now afraid to sleep in their room at night and come to our bed. They don't sleep well and wet the bed, and when they wake up, they are scared to go to the bathroom." The assault has also garnered a strong condemnation from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, which called on international bodies to exert pressure on the fabricated regime of Israel to cease its daily violations of human rights in Palestine. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shatayeh denounced the egregious violation against the Ajlouni family, stating, "Violating the sanctity of our homes and harming our women is a provocative, disgraceful and terrible act, which is practiced only by those who are stripped of morals and human values." Meanwhile, the Human Rights Committee of the Palestinian Parliament characterized the strip search as a demonstration of the extent of the ugliness and fascism of the occupation before the world, and urged the formation of an international investigation committee. They added, "The Hamas resistance movement vowed revenge, deeming the incident a dangerous escalation that the Palestinian people and the resistance will not ignore. The violations committed by the fascist occupation will fall in the face of our steadfastness until the last soldier and settler are uprooted from our occupied land." Tariq Salami, spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, called on Palestinians in Al-Khalil and other West Bank cities to escalate their confrontations with the occupation and avenge the assault.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be talking about an interesting question. This is a question related to history and also to theology. As you know, today marks the anniversary of the martyrdom of the eighth Imam of the family of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha. And for this, here at IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our condolences to our listeners on this most sad and solemn day. As you know, Imam Ridha alayhi salam, he was forced to migrate from Medina to Khorasan in Iran, because the caliph of the time, Ma'mun, he wished to transfer political power after himself, after his death, to Imam Ridha. In other words, he made him his heir, and he designated him as his vicegerent after him. And there's a lot of debate about why, Ma'mun did this, and whether it was correct or not, whether it was a good act or not. Today we're going to address this question, and it's interesting to note that in a hadith, Imam Ridha, it's been narrated that Imam Ridha had a conversation with Ma'mun about this topic. So we can look at this hadith and we can draw inspiration from it and see whether this act that he did, it was something good or bad, whether it was correct or not. A person named Abu Salt, this is a companion of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, he narrates the following. Ma'mun said the following to Imam Ridha, O son of the Prophet, verily I see it best for me to relinquish the caliphate and hand it over to you and swear allegiance to you. Imam Ridha alayhi salam said the following in response to him. He said, if this caliphate indeed belongs to you, meaning you rightfully deserve it, and Allah has assigned it to you, consequently Allah would have assigned it to you, then it is not permissible for you to remove it as a garment that Allah has clothed you with and assign it to another instead of yourself. If you really deserve it and Allah has given it to you, why are you transferring it to me? That means that I don't deserve it. You're transferring it to a person who doesn't deserve it. That's wrong for you to do so. And then the Imam, in continuation of his argument against Ma'mun, he said, and if the caliphate is not actually yours, meaning you don't deserve it, then it is not permissible for you to assign it to me. It's not permissible for you to assign to me that which is not yours in the first place. And you don't really deserve it. Who gives you the right and authority to transfer it to me? In response to this very convincing argument, Ma'mun said the following. O son of the Prophet, you have to accept this post. Here the Ma'mun, he appealed to force here, right? So logic is gone down the drain and he's cast it aside. He's forcing the Imam now to accept it. To which the Imam replied, I will never do that willingly through my own free will. If you're forcing me to do so, that's a different story. For by that, my acceptance of it, you want people to say, here the Imam, he's showing and he's kind of manifesting the true intentions and motives of Ma'mun. You want people to say, Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha did not abstain from worldly pursuits of leadership, but it is the world that has turned its back on him. Do you not see how he has accepted to be the heir apparent in his greed for the caliphate? When he said this, Ma'mun became angry and said, I swear to Allah, if you do not accept the position of heir apparent, I will force you to it, so you had better accept it, or else I will behead you. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the motives of Ma'mun in designating Imam Ridha alayhi salam as his heir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Iranian foreign minister lashes out at the U.S. for imposing new sanctions on his country, saying that Tehran will respond to such measures in kind. Representatives of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement and a mediation team from Oman are in Saudi Arabia to negotiate a permanent ceasefire. Also in deadlines, Burkina Faso expelling the French embassy's military attaché over what it calls subversive activities.